Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, January 16th, 2020. Tons of news items to talk about tonight. The voter fraud issue has raised its head again, and Tom Fenton with Judicial Watch has just released a video. It talks about letters they have written to five states regarding over-enrollment of voter lists. And what happens then is these become mail-in votes for the Democrats. This has been going on apparently since Janet Reno back in the Clinton days. This is where the Clinton machine actually really took root so they could control elections. And remember, Janet Reno was the Attorney General under Bill Clinton. And she really was a puppet. She did what they said. And, for example, Waco, when Billy Clinton first came to Washington in, 92 is when he would actually take an office. Janet Reno was the spear point for Hillary Clinton, who orchestrated the Waco massacre of all those people there because they were holding records. The short version of this was that the CIA was drug trafficking into Mena, Arkansas. If you don't know anything about this, look at the movie American Made with Tom Cruise. It talks about Barry Seal. And what they kind of allude to it in there, the Bushes and the Clintons, and the CIA drug trafficking into Mena, Arkansas. But when Billy went to Washington, everybody knew about Mena, Arkansas, so they moved their operation to Waco, Texas. And so, anyway, the Branch Davidian compound just happened to be next to the Waco airport where they were flying in C-110s loaded with drugs. And the Branch Davidian, David Koresh, and those people were out there videotaping this to make it public. So they had the Hillary Clinton, through Janet Reno, went into the with the FBI and massive amounts of firepower and killed all those people. Only a very few survived. But anyway, the whole issue of maintaining illegitimate voter lists began with Janet Reno. She made an order to places like California, other select places around the country, to start. In fact, she told them, do not erase voters off of the voter rolls. The standard process under federal law is that they have to send out it's basically a little card saying, do you still live at this address? And this is for people that are registered to vote in any of the 50 states. And then the people should fill it out and say, yes, we still live here. We still live here, and they send it back. So that's the procedure. Well, Janet Reno stopped that procedure, but was very forceful that you could not eliminate people from voter lists if they did not respond to that survey. Okay, so anyway, the long story short is that now there are places like Los Angeles County that have 1.5 million people on their voter rolls that don't belong there, that don't live there anymore. And those people are used for massive cheating. And that's what my voter fraud study was about, which I'm now posting per the recommendation of John Moore. I sent it to John. John is posting it on his webpage about the massive election cheating that went on in the 2016 presidential election and in the 2018 midterm election. And so you can see all of that. It's a short read. It's 2 pages. Then there's a one-hour lecture that goes along with that. And then you go to internet pages and look at the voter counts, and you follow through. And I do mathematical regression analysis using 3 different methods, ultimately 4 different methods, to show that there were 17 million illegal votes in the 2016 presidential election, something that the Democrats are trying to do again. But back to the original story, Tom Fenton, Judicial Watch, has sent letters to 5 states, which includes hundreds of counties, California, Colorado, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, and Virginia. Then that, just keep that in mind, Virginia, because that'll tie into the next story I'll be talking about. The Virginia rally that's coming up here next, I believe that's next Tuesday. And that's going to be, I've had long conversations during radio interviews on that. The short version is that could be used for a false flag event to try and blame the Patriots who are going there as a show of Second Amendment rights, to turn it into a shooting match with planted operatives, etc., like we know they've done before. For example, with a motorcycle rally that was held, I think it was in Texas, in which hundreds of motorcyclists were shot, and they know that the snipers were up on roofs around this place. So anyway, this is just going to be, we'll see. I'll be probably talking about this next week as to what had happened. And I've recommended that if people go there, to be heavily armed with cameras, so that if something starts, you can see exactly who started it, etc. Okay, so anyway, back to voter fraud. But Tom Fitton and his group, his attorney staff, have sent letters to five states identifying them as having over 127%, in other words, let me just complete the statement, 127% of living voters in their area. So that they take everybody over 18, they take a count of those people. That's everybody that could vote. And of course, in a real voting situation, only about who knows what percentage of those people actually register and then vote. But the voter registration rolls have 127%. That means far more people registered than even live there. So an absolute impossible situation, but this is being maintained, and that's how the Democrats won the House. That's how they won Virginia. The voter corruption in the United States is horrific. In the three main ways they do it is through electronic voting machines, where you don't see the result. There's no paper result, no tracking, and the voting machines are owned by basically companies that fix them. They can be adjusted remotely, etc. So anyway, that's one. But the biggest method of cheating in an election is with the mail-in votes. These are the voter rolls that what they do, here's literally what they do, is if people do not respond to their little card that's sent out, then somebody says, oh, okay, well, these people don't live there anymore, so they are going to be a mail-in vote. And so they literally write up a vote for them, for the Democrats, and send it in. And who knows if it even goes in the mail. It probably never even goes in the mail. It just is there invisibly in the precinct. And even if you put watchers, people to watch the election in the precincts during the election, all this is invisible. And so it's not something that's visible to the average person watching the election. So it's a pretty slick deal if you're a Democrat getting elected. And that I've made the assumption that there are possibly Democrats who have never, ever, have been in office for years, decades, a whole career, who've never been legally elected. And so now that leads us into, but anyway, these states don't care. These states do not care because they are, you know, it's really a mentality that it's like cheating on tests to get an A. It's like the Lori Lofgren, is that how you say her name? Mentality that this is what they can use money or influence or some other means to get what they want, and they just do it. There's no conscience anymore. There's no ethics. There's no ethical standards for people who push for what they want and impose it on other people. And so the same with voting. You have little old men and little old ladies down the street, your neighbors, who are in those local precincts cheating so that the Democrats win. And they think it's their, you know, that's their obligation. That's their part in saving the country. So anyway, voter fraud is going to be a big part of the 2020 election, and that's how it's done. So it's done through the electronic voting machines. That's the third method. The second method is, which is the biggest one, is the mail-in vote. And the other one is, there's actually two more. The other one is simply filling out votes and putting them in boxes because the vote doesn't have anybody's name on it. So we know they were doing this in the three recount states for Jill Stein, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, and Pennsylvania. We know they were doing that. Just, you know, so they had boxes of votes that people had filled in all the same handwriting, etc. So then the other way was simply at the precinct level, increasing the numbers. If the vote was 10,000, they put 20,000 or 30,000, whatever. And so anyway, it's an absolute disaster. My estimation is that if there were an election today or next November, and you put all of the candidates, all of the Democratic candidates on the ticket at the same time, Trump would win about 80% to 20% of the popular vote. And similarly with the Electoral College. And so, of course, that's why they want to do away with the Electoral College, because stuffing the ballot box in one location does not beat the Electoral College. They almost did it in the 2016 election, but Trump's team just outsmarted them. And so anyway, if you go to, say, look at the Trump rallies that have occurred over the past weeks, Ohio and some of the other ones, it was Wisconsin, in which people stood out in the cold for up to 2 days before to be in line to get into the stadium. That's, you know, rock stars don't get that. And so whether you like Trump or not, he's very popular with the populace, and to draw those kind of crowds. And then you look at the Bernie Sanders or the Liz Warrens or the Bidens, they're lucky to draw 200 or 300 people in a little auditorium. It's absolute, you know, it's a stadium full of people for Trump in a little room with a few people sitting down, not saying anything, for the Democrats. How do they claim to be able to win a national election? Well, it's by cheating. They don't have a voter base. They don't have voter platform. It's simply by cheating. Okay. Just a quick note, and the impeachment drama is unfolding in Washington, D.C. I'm not going to mention anything about that. It just gets crazier every day. So anyway, all the other news media are covering that. So pick your news outlet de jour, and you can listen to that there. But what I do want to talk about, I just want to quickly mention the Virginia rally coming up next week. The people who were elected in the Virginia governor office, etc., were clearly voted by cheating. There's no way that those people could have been elected there in a fair election. You have 92 of the 95 counties in Virginia that have become sanctuary counties by unanimous vote. So there's no way that somebody, that a Democrat toting anti-Second Amendment anti-gun laws, there's no way they could even get elected in that state. Absolutely impossible. So once again, voter cheating, and that's going to be a pivotal point in the history of this country, because they're not going to let that event go by without some kind of making it into a false flag event. I'm just very worried about that. I've mentioned it on the radio in a number of interviews, and I'm not the only person saying that. There are a lot of people saying, who was it, Mike Adams, I believe, the health ranger, and who was the other person saying that, I think it was Dave Hodges, I don't quote me because I forget who all was saying this on the radio show, that this is a perfect opportunity for a false flag event where somebody comes in there, puts plants in there, starts shooting, and blames it on the the Patriot Militia Movement. Okay, so I'll be certainly talking about that next week. Trade deal with China. Now, I happen to know quite a bit about trade to China. I happen to be involved in trade to China. My water filters are made in the United States. But when it came to, for example, the wing generator, I went out and I tried to get my design material built in the United States, and I could not do it. So I went to China. They came in with excellent equipment, absolutely fantastic manufacturing. And so some of the components in my wing generators are made in China. And so it's an amazing, and most of the innards, let's put it that way, the components are actually manufactured in the United States. So the metal housings, the fabricated sheet metal housings, and some of the physical parts, the doors and the hinges and things like that, are actually fabricated in China, and they're very good, high quality. The paint job is excellent. All of the hardware associated, but the electronics, most of it is made in the United States and assembled in China. So that's my association with China, and they are fantastic people to work with, very astute, very on top of things. Very on top of orders, something I cannot always say for my American counterparts. Dealing with American counterparts, the Chinese are very much on top of their orders, delivering on time, delivering high quality consistently. And so anyway, as far as the tariffs, I do pay some tariff on some items. And I just eat that cost because I can't get my products built in the United States at any price. And I tried to deal with some American companies, and what came back was just garbage, very poorly done, mistakes in very high precision electronics, mistakes. Terrible mistakes. And so I just said, no, I can't do this. So I went to China. The Chinese are wonderful to deal with. Very businesslike people. They're on time. They build a consistent product. And I know what to expect with them. When I have a question, they answer it within minutes. And if they're on a weekend, they answer their emails. Something you do not get in the United States, you got to wait till Monday morning. And then they come back and they're, you know, drinking their coffee, and it might be Tuesday or Wednesday before they get back to you. The Chinese get back to you when you write to them. But the thing that's been going on is that there's been problems with certain companies that want to produce in China, and the Chinese have been stealing their technology. I don't have to worry about that because there's nobody else selling my equipment. That's just the short end of it. So I don't have issues with that with China. But the trade deal is very important, and that's something that had built up over decades of absolutely taking the United States to the cleaners. So the first phase of that was signed yesterday, a hallmark agreement. And this is why, can you imagine, let me just insert a little bit of politics here. Liz Warren or Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden, none of them have ever run a business. Running a business is different than being a government official or a university professor. There you have no responsibility, no accountability, no bottom line, no balance sheet. You just can say whatever you want, and there's no recourse. You can think whatever you want, and it's just a classroom. Nobody cares. It has no effect on anybody. There's no bottom line. How can a person like that even imagine running a country, let alone, say, a national insurance policy? That's why national insurance policies have always failed, because they're run by politicians that have no experience running an insurance company. What, they don't know anything about it. So anyway, Trump is a businessman. And let me put it this way. For people that don't like Trump, good. Then you should vote for him because you want the biggest jerk on your side of the table when it comes to international dealings. Yes, that's right. If this guy is a royal jerk and really a hardcore you-know-what, you want him on your side of the table when you're dealing with foreign countries because it's really a shooting match out there. And in the past, the United States has gotten its butt kicked royally because of these floozy, hoosie-woosie politicians who don't know anything, never ran a business. Can you imagine Liz Warren or Bernie Sanders has never even run a little corner, Kool-Aid stand and had to make a profit and count the money. Never been a paper boy, never... they've never done anything. How are they going to run the United States of America with all its complications and foreign relations? I mean, that'd be asking, I couldn't do it. I could not be president. And most other people could not be president because it's too complicated. You need somebody that can manage at that complicated level and understands tariffs and exchange rates and banking and trade and tariffs and how to manage other countries and what their hot button is and how to maneuver in trade deals. These other people would be babies to the slaughter, and you would be the victim. On to the next topic. The Philippine explosive volcano Taal has been exploding, and it's gone off 34 times in the last 450 years, and it's had explosive events. They're evacuating people. I understand as of yesterday, they actually opened up the airport in Manila again, a number of airlines opening up flights into Manila. But still, this could go at any second and shut down again because of this volcano. But I've seen some orange sunsets and sunrises lately also. Okay, just a little bit of note on spring flooding. It's starting. It's already starting. Some of the southern states, they're talking about a dam. I think it's in Natchez, down south there, a couple of hundred miles from the Delta, from the Mississippi River Delta, where a dam potentially could break. They're talking about a dam that's failing, and that's one of the problems with physical dams and especially hydro dams and water reserves, etc., is that eventually the footings give out. And when that happens, it's catastrophic, because once that water starts moving, there's nothing that's going to stop it. We've seen this in California. Remember the dam up above Fresno? What was it, a year ago, 2 years ago, that the first of all, they had the drought, and then all of a sudden they had all this rain, and now there's one down south there. So eventually water wins. That's one thing you can say about water. It's going to find a way, and once it does, it starts seeping through, eroding, and then it erodes away the foundations, and then adios, amigo. That thing is going to break and cause catastrophic flooding down below the dam, where in a lot of cases you had people building up residence. The dam is up above and people built along the riverbanks, etc., down below. And if that baby goes, a lot of expensive property could be flooded and lost. But we're still waiting for, of course, the spring melt that starts moving northwards. Soon, with the snow melt, we're going to have to see what that brings this year. But my plan has always been to take that snow melt and, using the wing generator and wind, moving that water to the American Southwest. We have untold amounts of land that would be very, very productive farmland, but it doesn't have water. So if you could green that area, then all of a sudden it would start to rain again, and we would have, how many states down there? Nevada, Arizona, Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Southern California. All of those states could be greened, so an immense amount for fruit and vegetables. It would just be unheard of. You know, the valley up in California, part of its success is due to water. And, so we could have so much food on this planet Earth, it would just be a garden of paradise. And so anyway, this is somewhat part two of my analysis. That are we going to be able to continue with this economy and job situation into the distant future? You know, everybody having a 40-hour-a-week job, and I mean, it's a good system, but you have to wonder how far is this going to go. But the other issue is we have to put value on hand labor, and this is for everybody, not just illegal immigrants or something like that, if you plan properly, you know, here's a little fun statistic that the average Native American who lived in the United States before the white man came spent about 4 hours on average getting food. And that includes buffalo hunts or, you know, shooting deer or whatever. And gathering crops or whatever. They only spent about 4 hours a week. And so that's because there was such immense bounty in this country. It was just everywhere. And I've been personally to places like that, too, where people are just giving you food. Here, take this. You know, and it's like fruit and vegetables and things like avocados that grow on trees. And literally, there's so much food that it really rots because you can't eat it all. There's not enough people to eat all the food, and it's just growing. It's, you know, people have maintained like 2 or 3 acres. You can't even imagine how much food you can grow on a couple acres. You got the chickens on the ground, you got some goats, maybe one cow. Most people in these kind of situations don't have cows because they're really tough to manage. Goats are much better. And the goat's milk is much better, etc., goat's cheese, etc. But, I mean, they have fruits and vegetables, all different kinds. They have so much food that they don't even know what to do with it all. That's the normal situation in a lot of places. And, of course, these are poor people. They don't have a lot of money, but they live very good. They live to be, they're comfortable, they're happy. They spend a lot of time with their families. And, so they spend a lot of time visiting on a daily basis and talking about just daily things, you know, and that's what life should be about. The American dream has turned into this, you know, this racing to, you know, the stock market yesterday hit an all-time high daily. It's just with the signing of the China deal, it just went up again. I mean, that's great. But my question is, how long can we do this? How long is this going to go on? I mean, and you potentially could keep doing it, recycling resources, making better cars, nicer cars, you know. But at a certain point, you know, it's like, let's slow down and just start enjoying life. And, the world has been kept in a knot by the news media, and that's by design. Yeah, because the news media, is, if you're a European banker, then you want all of these countries fighting. You want them interdependent on natural resources. They want the U.S. dependent on Mideast oil, and they want the Mideast dependent on U.S. food and all these international interdependencies. And everybody's locked in a big mess is literally what's going on. And so life goes on, and that's how they control the world. Basically, and then the CIA is out there causing all kinds of conflicts, and so you got the United States out there running around with their armies running into every country in the world. And so what Trump wants to do is bring all these people back, which is fine. You know, leave the Middle East. That's fine. Just leave it. Bye. You know, and we don't need anything there. We're energy independent now. But we're using more and more energy, and that is not good. It is not good to use this vast amount of energy. the coal and the natural gas and petroleum-based products, etc., nuclear. By the way, nuclear is not green. Nuclear is not green. It's the most horrific polluting energy source on the planet. And anybody who says nuclear is green is a liar. They're a con man, and they're saying that for the profit of the nuclear industry, which shouldn't even be here. But to get back to my first original point is that with the spring runoff, we should be moving that water, instead of letting it dump down into the Gulf of Mexico, we should be moving that water off to the American Southwest, where it could be used, and it's relatively flat there. Remember, there's a big drop that comes from the mid-states down as you get down to Louisiana, and so we could cut it off somewhere mid, I don't know, maybe north of St. Louis, and divert that water over to the American Southwest using wind energy to pump the water. And in a couple of years, we would have an amazing, amazing amount of food coming out of the American Southwest. That's one of my 11 Earth mega projects, by the way, that's listed on my homepage. Spring flooding coming up, and we'll see how that goes. I'll keep you tuned as that proceeds. This is a must listen, this next topic. A guy named Ricky Gervais, I don't know, I'm not saying that right, it's Gervais, or not sure, it's spelled Ricky is R-I-C-K-Y, his last name is G as in George, G-E-R-V-A-I-S. And he did the monologue, he does the, annually, he's done the monologue for the Golden Globe Awards, but this year was especially telling, let's just put it that way. He really stuck it in the eye of the Hollywood elite. Now, the Golden Globe Awards are the awards for movies, etc. So you had the Leo DiCaprio, you had your Brad Pitts, you know, all of the big stars, that you know, Al Pacino, everybody, all the big stars are there. And they are, you know, this is an award ceremony, but you have to go on the internet, go to YouTube, which I don't recommend YouTube at all, especially for science. Don't go to YouTube for science at all. But anyway, go to YouTube, or this might be on other platforms also, but listen to the Ricky Gervais monologue from the Golden Globe Awards for 2020. And it's just amazing how he sticks it in the eye of all of these big stars out there. And, you got to listen to it. I'm not going to go through and repeat it. Just once again, a must listen for everybody. Ricky Gervais, G-E-R-V-A-I-S, the monologue, his monologue from the 2020 Golden Globe Awards. Okay, on to the next topic. Now, my paid cast, I've been involved in the education program, a two-year education program for K-12 and university. And I'm interrupting that because something happened. I'm not stopping the paid cast. What I'm doing is I'm stopping my two-year education program to insert something. So the months of November and December will have this response to Neil deGrasse Tyson, who has put out what's known as a master class. Now, master classes are supposedly taught by experts in their field, and some of these people you would consider to be experts. Other of them I consider kind of fluff, people who have made a name for themselves and really don't have a lot of good, I wouldn't call them world leaders, etc. Some of them are kind of political, etc. But Neil deGrasse Tyson, let's examine who he is. Let's go back to the original Cosmos series with Carl Sagan. That was when I was at Cornell University. I was in the math and physics department, writing my papers on space science and astronomy, getting them published in astrophysics journals. And all of a sudden, the hammer came down. I was not welcome in Cornell University. And my teaching was excellent. Everything I was doing was top work. I had students signing petitions that I would teach their class. And I was in the face of NASA because I realized that they were conning the American public as the spacecraft data came back from all around the solar system. So during those 2 years, 79 to 81, those two academic years, Carl Sagan was in Hollywood making the Cosmos series. Carl Sagan got the Cosmos series lecturer position because, number one, he was the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy from Cornell, probably one of the highest chairs. A chair means you're like kind of next to God. You don't just literally sit in a chair. It's like a position. It's an exonerary position. But anyway, he got the Cosmos series because he led the charge against Emmanuel Velikovsky and destroyed Velikovsky in all respects, muddied up his name, called him the crazy old man. The CIA was involved in this, and Carl Sagan was the winner. He was the guy that led the charge, gathered all the other people, Stephen Jay Gould and the whole laundry list of other people that attacked Velikovsky at the 1977 American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS meeting, when 1977 was to destroy Velikovsky. They planned it, they executed it, and then had a follow-up book and publication, and basically Velikovsky was the most popular name in astronomy in the world. His books, Worlds in Collisions, Ages in Chaos, and Earth in Upheaval, were international bestsellers, translated into 14 languages, by far outselling any other book, which is strange. You know, it's a book about comets and ancient destruction, etc., and using factual information. And basically, he was talking about calendars, which is a very esoteric topic. But anyway, Sagan is the guy that took him, Velikovsky, to the cleaners. And for that, he was rewarded with the Cosmos series, which was a 14-series mini-series and talking about astronomy. And this was to put astronomy kind of on the table for the public. And Sagan's attitude was, we're smart, you're dumb, we know the answers, you just listen to what we say, and we've got this all figured out. So that was the whole attitude of the Cosmos series, and also to teach atheistic science with evolutionary cosmology and evolutionary biology at its core. Okay, so back to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil deGrasse Tyson is a protege of Carl Sagan. Neil deGrasse Tyson is the curator of the Hayden Planetarium in New York. So that's one of the highest level planetarium positions, and also is known for being an astrophysicist, although his credentials in actually doing astrophysics are questionable. Neil deGrasse Tyson is what we call, or what I call, a Tier 2 scientist. He's a textbook reader, textbook repeater, and he repeats all the right things, the Big Bang, black holes, on and on and on. Okay, so he's all over the internet. He's done multiple TV specials. He's done, you know, an immense amount of interviews with top people. He's been on, like, the Tonight Show, etc., and on, talking about astronomy and astrophysics and the Big Bang and the universe and all kinds of things. So anyway, he's doing, and if you've been anywhere on the internet, you've probably seen these pop-up ads where he's kind of their point man for these master classes. And so anyway, he did a master class on how to think critically, basically. And he wants to teach you how to think so that you come to all the correct conclusions regarding astronomy and the universe. So anyway, I'm going to take this guy. Now, let me just say this also. Back in my paid cast, I forget, about a year or two ago, I took the Cosmos series. So just to fill in the blanks here, Tyson, Neil deGrasse Tyson, redid the original Carl Sagan Cosmos series. Neil deGrasse Tyson redid it, basically using the same talking points, and then put it out again for another run. And this was edited and sponsored by Andruyan. Now, Andruyan was Carl Sagan's second wife, was his secretary during the Cosmos series, and did a lot of the writing for the Cosmos series. And so anyway, she got together and wanted to, of course, Carl Sagan is dead, and so they got Neil deGrasse Tyson to be the spokesperson, the guy on the camera, the face. And so now he's doing this master class on how to think critically, and it's just so full of holes that it is not funny. So what I'm doing in my paid cast is I'm taking the master class of Neil deGrasse Tyson apart piece by piece and showing you how this fits into the world of not critical thinking, but trying to convince you, once again, that you're the public, you're dumb, they're smart, you follow what their directions on thinking, and you will arrive to their conclusions and believe what they're telling you. And the reality is, when it comes right down to so-called science, they don't have science. They don't have anything. All of the so-called science regarding Big Bang and the black holes and general relativity is circumstantial. There's not a shred of real science involved. And so Neil deGrasse Tyson is basically a point man. He's the guy that can talk so that you don't have to, or that you can't ask real questions of NASA and the astronomy community. They're all back there in the background hiding, and they got Neil deGrasse Tyson out there, you know, who's clearly worth a lot of money, basically, from doing this type of work. And, of course, he believes what he's doing. He believes he's, you know, doing an honest job. But there's no dialogue. Let me repeat that. There's no dialogue. Let me go back into the early 2000s. I got a call from George Norrie on Coast to Coast when I used to be on Coast to Coast AM quite a bit as a guest. And he called me up and he says, we want a debate and we want you to be in the debate and we want you to debate David Morrison. David Morrison is Carl Sagan's favorite student. And David Morrison is the head at the time in the early 2000s, was the head of the near-Earth asteroid, I don't know if it's a program or something like that. It's called NEAR, N-E-A-R, I believe. But it was to study near-Earth asteroids that could be damaging to Earth and catalog them and study them, etc. And David Morrison was the head of that. And, of course, that was part of that was studying comets, and because David Morrison would be considered a comet expert, as would be Carl Sagan, a dirty snowball comet expert. And, of course, that's been demonstrably proven absolutely false. The Europeans have landed on the surface of a comet. There's no ice. There's no snow. All they found were organic molecules, not any H2O in any form. And there was nothing coming off the nucleus, so comets could not possibly be dirty snowballs. It's proven, yet they still talk about it. But anyway, going back to the early 2000s, so they, Coast to Coast, hosted this debate. It was David Morrison and myself. And I won the debate with a call-in vote. I won handsomely in a political election. You would have called it a landslide. And so amazing to me, I expected no way that I would win a debate against NASA's top scientist. But at any rate, the part of this whole part of me bringing this up is that this is the these are the people that are visible in NASA, and then everybody else in the background can sit there and not do anything and are basically hidden. There's no dialogue. There's no conversation even, and there's certainly no debate. But my point is that I'm taking time out of my paid cast. I'm putting in my paid cast my dialogue, because there is no dialogue. It'll be my response to this so-called master class of Neil deGrasse Tyson that's supposedly going to teach you how to think, and pick it apart point by point, just like I did with the Cosmos series. And so that's also in my paid cast. So I encourage you to join my paid cast. This will also be on my Patreon channel. I'll be putting this up as content on my Patreon channel, which is patreon.com/JMCCSCI, the same as my webpage. So that's patreon.com/JMCCSCI. And you can go there and contribute. That page just went up. It's just getting started, but I'm going to use this content criticizing the Neil deGrasse Tyson so-called masterclass and picking it apart point by point to show you that basically this is a facade. And like I say, Neil deGrasse Tyson thinks he's doing a good job. You know, he thinks he's defending the Reich, standard astronomy. And now that, let me just give you a brief glimpse into this. Basically, what they're saying is that, what he starts out by saying is that you think you know enough to think you're right, but not enough to know you're wrong. And that's the tack he's taking. In other words, the same as Carl Sagan. We have all of this study. It's so immense, and we're smart, and you're dumb, and no matter how hard you try, you're never going to achieve the level of knowledge of us, so that proves that you're wrong. That's the so-called fuzzy logic that they're using here. So these are layers of protection. This is protectionism. It's like there's a corrupt group of people, and they send out their emissaries to fend off any commentary, etc. And so you, as somebody trying to intrude on this system, you can't get near them, because out there is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's the front man. He's the guy out there beating on the drum. He's the guy selling you the snake oil. So anyway, I would suggest go to my paid cast or go to my Patreon channel, and I'll take this once again, pick it apart piece by piece, and then fill it in with the real science that's going on this planet and in the universe. And of course, once again, they're using the tack that they have this immense body of knowledge. And if you look at it, it's near infinite, but it's based on a foundation that doesn't exist. And that's the problem, because with every piece of data that comes in, they simply assume, they believe that their assumptions are correct. And so they interpret the data in a certain way. So it's like when I was at Cornell, there was a secretary. She typed my original book. During the first year I was there, I wrote a book. It was dealing with comets and the planetary development from comets, etc. And her name was Marie Jones. She was Carl Sagan's secretary. She was secretary for other people also, but she was also Carl Sagan's secretary. And she used to laugh because the staff there really didn't have high regards for the professionals and the PhDs there. And of course, that's where I first heard the term piled higher and deeper for a PhD. My question to her was, why don't, you know, I'm in the space science library all the time. I'm in the physics library. I'm in the science library all the time, and I never see these people. I never see the Joe Vavurkas. I never see the Carl Sagans. I never see any of these highfalutin NASA scientists there. And she said, oh, they don't go to the library. If they want a publication, they get the secretary to go over there and get it and then bring it back to them. They're too important to go to the library because they already know everything. That was her response. And of course, a bit of tongue-in-cheek there. But anyway, this is an amazingly grandiose system built on a pile of sand that can wash away in a minute. But they, back to the main point, what they do is they rely on this like, look at this infinite amount of people and the tens of thousands of scientists that work in this. How could they possibly be wrong? Well, very easily, because they all started at the wrong starting point. And let me also, there's kind of a human element here in believability, because a song has a beginning, has an end. It has a starting thought, it has a conclusion. A movie has a beginning, it has an end. And this is the way the human psyche works. If you had a song that was simply ongoing and ongoing and ongoing and never ended, it probably wouldn't have much human interest, because people want it resolved. They want to move on to the next thing. And the same with a movie. We have TV series, but even those, they put on an annual basis. It begins and it ends. Life begins and it ends. Animals, your pet is born and it dies. The planet more than likely had a beginning, and it's someday going to have an end of some kind. And so the human psyche always is looking for a beginning and an end. And so that's why the Big Bang is somewhat satisfying to the average Joe on the street, because it gives a beginning and end to the universe, some kind of closure. Oh, okay, it's a closed box. It began, it ended, there's no more that you have to say about it, because it fits in with the human psyche inability to understand the infinity. And let's go to mathematics a little bit. When I'm dealing with prime numbers, for example, one of the or all of the major problems, unsolved problems in mathematics, I would say could be, they're diverse, they're different, but they typically have to do some element of infinity. And see, the human mind cannot understand infinity. So there was a set of postulates, very brilliant set of work, two major contributions to the world of infinity in mathematics. One was by a guy named George Cantor, who described infinities, and that there are infinities that are bigger than some infinities. Like if you count, a basic example, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and you keep counting all the way to infinity, of course you'll never get there. No matter how many generations continue counting, you'll just never even get close to infinity. And so George Cantor gave an example of infinities, but what if between every number 1 and 2, and every number 2 and 3, and 3 and 4, there was an infinity number of, say, rational numbers. Well, then there has to be more rational numbers than integers, right? Because between every two integers, there's an infinite number of rational numbers. And between every two rational numbers, there has to be an infinite number of real numbers. So the infinity of real numbers is bigger than the infinity of rational numbers, which is bigger than the infinity of integers. So at any rate, this could go on and on, but understanding infinities is something that the human mind just has a real tough time with. And the other mathematical advancement to understand infinities comes from something called Peano's postulates. It's P-E-A-N, I think there's two N's, O, an Italian mathematician who built what are known as Peano's postulates. I use it in my work on prime numbers. And basically it says that if you can create an element and then define its successor, and every successor then can be have another successor defined by the same process, then that gives you what is known as induction. So there's a lot of mathematical proofs that are proved by induction. And that's a tool that I use particularly in my work, but it's another way that humans can understand the concept of infinity. But when it comes to space science, etc., let's take a look at the biggest telescope. Let's go back to the early 1900s, when the biggest telescope could just barely resolve the nearest galaxies. And all of a sudden, Edwin Hubble had access to these telescopes, and he looked out into space, and he sees that they're all these galaxies, that there's lots of them out there, and they're, you know, that's, then they start to understand that our star is part of one galaxy, and there's lots of them. So every time they built a bigger telescope in the history of astronomy, they could see farther, and the farther they looked, they would always see, you know, a lot more galaxies. So today, they have the Hubble Space Telescope, for example, and they focused the Hubble Space Telescope on an area of space that was black. There was nothing there. Nobody had ever seen anything, even with the biggest telescopes. They had never seen anything in this kind of black region out in space. So they looked out into this black region and trained the Hubble Space Telescope on it for a long exposure. And lo and behold, there were billions of galaxies in this region. So as far as you can see, there's more galaxies and stars, etc. So what if you could go to that location where those galaxies are and then look beyond? Would you similarly see farther and farther? And that there's just, but even at that, the universe could be contained. There could be a limit. And so the human psyche, not being able to understand infinity, wants to put a limit on this. And so the Big Bang solves that issue too, by saying, well, if this all exploded in a Big Bang, then there's a limit on the outer edge of the known universe, and that's where it ends, and beyond there, there's nothing. And the other thing that it does is it can do all of this without a creator. And that's the beauty of the Big Bang, is because without saying it, you don't need God. You don't need a creator, and the atheists love that. So the Big Bang and the science they're preaching today is atheist science. Anyway, so go to my Paidcast or go to my Patreon channel, and you can contribute there, which is something that would be beneficial. A few people have started, and I hope that grows over time, over the years. And also my Paidcast. You can get some of these lectures also on my Paidcast, on my webpage, jmccsci.com, my Patreon channel is patreon.com/jmccsci. Also, just a brief mention now, remember that I have these containers for sale and container buildings. I now have a subpage for that particular product. So instead of emailing in, you can now go to the subpage and get all the information, actually get enough information where you can build an order, and then you contact us on the method of paying for it, etc. So once again, my webpage, jmccsci.com. If you're interested in the wing generator, write in and we'll send you a packet of information, a questionnaire, and get you started on the wing generator, something that if you have farm or ranch, very important. So once again, the website, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.